July 28th, Committee on Rules. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3129. Come on up. I got too many numbers in my head. Invite Senator Walker up. Oh, perfect timing. Representative Lim, come on up. My staff is doing other things, so you'll have to give us a little bit of background about this bill, which I'm sure you will anyway. So thank you very much.
Would you go first?
Okay. Madam Chair, Brown, and members of this committee, I really thank you very much for hearing the House Bill 3129. This has been waiting a long, long time, and I really do appreciate it.
Good things come to those who wait.
I have enough patience. According to the state law, Oregon high school students are only required to take 2 years of math and 3 years of English. This is one of the lowest standards in the country. And our country, among the 17 industrialized nations, we are the lowest in the math, and we need to improve that. House Bill 3129 will increase the math and English requirement to 3 years of math and 4 years of English so that we can come to par with most other states. Based on our office initial research, 44 states have higher standard than Oregon. Majority of these states require 4 years of English and 3 years of math. Only 6 states have 3 years of English and 3 years of math. That's Illinois, Utah, Missouri, California, Washington, and Oregon. 3 and 2 is the lowest standard in the nation. Arkansas and New Mexico and Texas require 4 years of English and additional studies in speech also. Some of the concern expressed that they're requiring 3 and 4 English and math will increase possible dropout of the students. But according to the study we have done, that the dropout rate is lower. Those states already require those 3 and 4. And we had that the Trade and Economic Committee meetings in Eugene area, most of the testified that they want the strong workforce in our state by requiring the higher bar, the requiring of English and math. We will come to the strong workforce in our state. I believe this is a good deal, and no one opposed this bill so far, and then I hope this have a work session today and pass out. And I'm open to questions if you have any questions.
Thank you. Representative Lim, we'll hold questions until Senator Walker joins you in testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I think you'll be looking at the A2 amendments today to this bill, and you'll have them shortly.
Thank you. I was panicking because I did not have them, but I understand you have them.
Yeah, I do.
And they're being passed out.
I do, Madam Chair. And what we did with those amendments is, well, first let me back up. I am a co-chief sponsor on House Bill 3129 because I believe as strongly as Representative Lim does that we need to increase these requirements. However, Oregon currently only requires students to graduate with 22 credits, and that was not enough credits to be adding additional requirements to. So I wanted to increase the graduation credits to 24, and I attempted to do that. I actually did do that, Madam Chair. You gave me the opportunity to work on House Bill 3162, the SIM-CAM bill. I worked that bill pretty extensively, created an amendment that did include that, among other things, but I understand that bill's not going forward. So we are now going forward with 3129, and if you approve it today, the A2 amendment, which would increase the graduation credits to 24. Madam Chair, I would just say to you, I did get a copy of a document from the Department of Education. It never did come to me in a complete form, but the form that I got, I asked them to provide to me information about the credits, graduation credits, credits required in all school districts in Oregon. And the document that I was given shows that 55 of the 198 school districts in Oregon already require 24 credits or more. 55, that's pretty good from what I see, and there may be more. I just don't have all the documents. But, Madam Chair, the one thing that was interesting is that some of the smaller school districts in the state have higher credits. Mm-hmm. Hermiston has 27. David Douglas, well, that's not a small, Days Creek is 24. Dayton School District, the town of Dayton, we celebrated its 125th birthday. 27 credits are already required for graduation in that school. So, Madam Chair, I think this is a good amendment. I'm glad you put that in. I had some other ideas for a seamless education system that I'd like to see go forward, and I'll continue to work on those in the interim. But I think it's important, as Representative Lim said, that we get our kids educated and up to the standards that students in other states are, and I don't think we can go wrong with passage of this bill with the A2 amendment.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Walker and Representative Lim?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
We all want better schools. I'm concerned that this means that we'll have more kids that won't get a high school diploma because they just won't take that many credits. And I guess your hope is that it will motivate those districts to require more education. The kids will take more education, but I think it might not have that effect. And obviously it doesn't add more resources. I'm also concerned that at the high school level, you have a certain set of kids that excel. They're gonna go on to higher ed and a lot of success. But you've got another set of kids that are just waiting to get out of high school, but they're spending 30 hours a week in a job, and they're kind of hanging as to whether they do or whether they don't get the diploma. And I think by moving in this direction, you're gonna push some of those kids over the edge so that they will not ever get their high school diploma.
Okay, may I respond?
Sure, Representative Lim.
Yes, Chair Brown and Senator Ringo. And in the bill, there's an opt-out clause there, and the first page, section 1, and at the line 13, and that has met or exceeded the academic content standards for mathematics or English established by the board, and that any student overachieving or underachieving, they have a chance to opt out by the policy decision of the board. So that was the concern already expressed. That's why we put it in this language there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Walker, did you want to respond to that as well?
Yes, Madam Chair. Actually, the -A2 amendment does not allow them to opt out of the 24 credits. It allows them to opt out of the additional math and English, but not the 24 credits. And frankly, I think that we need to raise that bar. And I would just leave you with a quote. I met with Jill Powers Kirk, who's vice president of the Oregon Business Council. Mm-hmm. I met with her on June 7th to discuss the SimCam bill. I have 6 pages of notes from that meeting. But one of the things that she said to me is one of the things that changed for her is that she read a column written by Tom Wicker in the late 80s about the sorry state of education. And his quote was, "We expected less of our kids, and they didn't disappoint us." I thought that was a very telling quote. It really turned Ms. Kirk's opinion around, and it really sank in with me. If we expect less of our kids, they won't disappoint us. Kids will strive for more if you give them the goal to strive for more. So I don't think this is onerous. I understand we underfund our education, and we're going to do it again this session. This does not kick in until 2009, so the students going into school as freshmen this year will be meeting those extra requirements. But I think, Senator Ringo, between now and then, we're going to do better by K through 12, because I'm going to continue to work on it, as are you and many others in this building. So I would urge you to give this a good start and a kickstart.
Thank you.
So I just want to clarify, Senator Walker, 24 credit hours plus 3 years of math and 4 years of English, correct?
Correct.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us. I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 3121. Senator Burdick, you're here on 3469. My recollection is that you've already testified on this bill. Did you wish to testify again? You do wish to testify again. Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3469.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jenny Burdick from Senate District 18, and I finally remembered to introduce myself this time. I just wanted to give my blessing and support to the -A3 amendment to House Bill 3469. I did testify on it before. These are both constructive changes, and I would urge the adoption of the -A3 amendment. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Senator Burdick?
Question.
Senator Farrielly.
Senator Burdick, the issue here really is protecting children from unwanted attention, so those that have indicated by their behavior that they're not to be trusted around kids. In some communities, we're seeing an effort at zoning where a registered sex offenders may live, not within 1,000 yards of a school, church, or place where children congregate, malls, public playgrounds, etc. Did you delve into any of those issues when you were working on this bill?
Well, we definitely delved into this issue in connection with Senator Ringo's bill in the Senate Judiciary, the three-mile limit bill.
Was that House Bill 2050?
Yes.
Okay.
And that was in the context of another bill. This is in the context of this situation came out of my district where a predatory sex offender was coming to the community center in the pool with the kids when they were swimming, in the locker room with the kids when they were showering, giving gifts, and so on. And it's grooming behavior, and we're trying to get at it in this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Senator Farrielly. Any other questions for Senator Burdick? Thank you very much.
Thank
appreciate you.
You
joining us this afternoon.
Oh, I appreciate the chat.
Oh.
Hi.
Okay. I'm going to switch now.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Mowat, for your prompt attention. We're going to close the public hearing. Yeah, you're welcome to join us. We're having very stimulating conversations on a number of bills.
I'll be right here for the next one.
Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 680. Senator Johnson, why don't you come on up? Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the measure?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 680A directs the Oregon Department of Aviation to set up a pilot program to foster economic development in areas adjacent to rural airports.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Welcome.
Question, Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
Yeah, it's aviation program with a pilot project. I just couldn't let that
all right. Madam Chair, Senator Shields, you got that right.
I just couldn't let that one pass.
No amendments.
The yes. Pilot okay. Project.
I haven't seen it.
Okay.
You got it.
All right. Senator Johnson, why should we pass this bill since we've already passed it once?
Once wasn't good enough, okay. Madam Chair. You get a second bite at this apple.
All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that this is a real jobs bill. There are evidence of the good effects of through-the-fence operations throughout Oregon in my home airport, which will probably not apply for this opportunity because it already has a through-the-fence policy. Ground will be broken sometime in the next couple of weeks on a $15-plus million capital investment, creating 100 jobs and providing goods and services to, among others, the United States military taking care of our men and women in uniform in Iraq. This is an opportunity for land that sits fallow next to rural airports, particularly, to have the opportunity to invite private capital and private entrepreneurial effort. It must be airport-related businesses so that they will be sympathetic with the activities at the airport. We think this is a chance to invite private capital and nimble development next to airports and encourage development and jobs.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Johnson? All right.
What is nimble development?
Yeah.
I like that one.
Fast.
Okay, good.
Be able to get out of the way of the airplane.
All right. Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 680? All right. I'm going to close the public hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 680.
I think it'll fly.
All right. right, Senator Shields has moved Senate Bill 680 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Farrioli.
I have to request an insulin shot.
Oh, man. Any further relevant discussion?
No.
All right, would you please call the roll?
Yes.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye. Motion passes. Senator Johnson will carry. Thank you very much. All right, we got Ms. Mowat here. Let's go. Yes, we will do that. Let's finish off 3129. We had three people signed up. Open a public hearing. Mr. Hunsinger, Ms. Darby, and someone else. Mr. Burke.
You got allergies?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kent Hunsaker. I'm the executive director for the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I'm testifying in favor of the Senate bill, however, with some cautions, and I wanted to bring out some of the cautions that have already been mentioned today by Senator Ringo. First of all, in terms of graduation requirements, the superintendents of this state recently sent a policy paper to the Department of Education in the area of mathematics. And the recommendation in that policy paper was that the mathematics requirement be increased to 3 years. And a further recommendation in that paper was that the testing that isn't done at 10th grade be done at 11th grade. And the main reason for that is that one of the reasons we're seeing a lack of progress in the area of mathematics is the students are taking the mathematics test without the skills to take that test. And that includes through algebra 2, and it's very difficult for students to get through algebra 2 by the 10th grade. So that's a piece of that. A couple of the cautions that I wanted to mention on this bill is that it comes into place in the 07-09 biennium with language arts being 07-08, mathematics being 08-09, and then the graduation requirements to 24 in 09-10. One thing I wanted to mention about the 07-09 biennium is that we already know that there will be big cost drivers for education in that biennium in the form of large increases in the PERS rate, continued increases in insurance. And one of the concerns that we have is that there wouldn't be additional funding allowed to implement this. If additional funding is not allowed to implement this, I believe that it will result in the loss of program offerings that members of this committee and members of our communities feel are very important, such things as reductions in maybe the arts, reductions in some vocational ed classes that do keep kids in school and keep them motivated. So along with this, in the 07-09 biennium, I'm just saying that this group is going to have some difficulty making sure that there's adequate funding to make sure that we can fund this in the proper fashion. One other thing that was already mentioned by Senator Ringo is that in this state, already all the kids that go to college take 4 years of language arts and 3 years of mathematics. In addition, 50 of the 198 school districts already require such things. So you're talking about a further requirement on a population of students that may have some unintended consequences. And some of that could be that some of these students that are in school where language arts and mathematics are not necessarily the most motivating things to them, it could be that it could increase the dropout rate. I do believe that it is really important, and in fact, in the chalkboard survey that was recently put out there, they said that the one thing that all people in the state agreed on is they wanted to see high standards for all kids. I think raising the graduation requirements would be a step in the right direction. However, the cautions are the ones that I mentioned. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Darby.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, my name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Education Association. We're here to support House Bill 3129. We believe that in our global economy, it is really important that Oregon also have high standards, and this is a good step in that direction to shoring that up and ensuring that all students have good opportunities to work on English and mathematics skills. We think that we appreciate that it's delayed until 2009 to give school districts an appropriate opportunity to review their curriculum, and we look forward to working with the State Board of Education to ensure that appropriate content standards and other considerations are adopted through the rulemaking process to help students that may have problems meeting these requirements. We look forward. We also have concerns about the budget and our continued underfunding, but we also believe it is important for students to have every opportunity to learn at a high level and compete both nationally and internationally, and this is a good step in that direction.
Thank you. Mr. Burke.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pat Burke. I'm the Chief Policy Officer of the Department of Education. I, too, am here to speak in support of the bill, particularly in the amendments that are before you today. First, we supported the bill before the House, and I wanted to express our appreciation both to Representative Lim and to Senator Walker for their support. One of the key amendments before the House was an opportunity to adjust the timeline so that the type of study and analysis on the number of new teachers that would be needed could be done in advance of the 07 session so that there would be a clearer idea of the fiscal impact of the long-term fiscal impact of this bill as it gets played out. The amendment before you, the A2 amendments before you, specify that further and looks at the full implementation by the 09-10 school year. We support that direction. Secondly, we wanted to support the amendment to add the 2 years or the 2 units of credit. Our concern with the original bill was that if it stayed within the 22 units of credit, there are currently 13 units of credit that are mandatory and 9 units of credit that are elective. And to just stay within the 22, there was a danger that you would lose electives, which are very important to kids, in favor of more mandatory courses. By moving from 22 to 24, we're able to prevent that from happening. And finally, this bill does move us closer to alignment with the college entrance requirements in the state. And as you know, both the Higher Education Board and the K-12 Board have been working very hard on system alignment issues. And this bill is a positive step in that direction. So for those reasons, Madam Chair, we support the bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? All right. Appreciate you joining us today. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3129. And I'm sorry, I forgot to announce. I tried pushing Legislative Council to have amendments ready on House Bill 2157, but they are not ready. They will not be ready till tomorrow. We hope they'll be ready tomorrow. So if anybody's in the audience waiting for 2157, it'll be tomorrow. And my apologies. All right. Let's go to work session on House Bill 3469. Invite Ms. Mowat up. And anybody else wishing to testify on the Dash 3 amendments on House Bill 3469? Mr. Schreiner, come on up. I knew there was someone else.
Afternoon.
Welcome.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, my name is Pat Schreiner. I am the commander of the Marion County Sheriff's Office Parole and Probation Division, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the Sex Offender Supervision Network. Unfortunately, when this bill first came up, we kind of missed the first bite at the apple to testify on it, and we did have some concerns and wanted to offer a friendly amendment. The intent of this bill makes sense. However, we do have some issues that there are lots and lots of offenders being designated as predatory, and this population that we supervise over the course of time, if they make progress in treatment, if they're participating and successful on supervision, very often, in fact, most often, they have families, they have people who are aware of their issues, are aware of who they are, and through treatment, through full disclosure, for the processes they go through, they end up getting permission to have supervised contact, to be at weddings, funerals, a variety of events where they may end up having children of their own over the course of time, and obviously they also go off of supervision, which falls out of our purview. But as far as one significant amendment from our point of view would be, we parole probation officers in collaboration with treatment providers approve safety avoidance plans for these offenders in the community. And now we're not talking about the really extreme, high-risk, dangerous offenders who should never be around kids. But the bottom line is that's a very small slice of that pie. Most of these folks do have situations where they do have something going like that, and that is approved. So one thing it looks like this bill would prohibit is we would not be doing those safety avoidance plans. We would be not approving that at all anymore, and we see that as a problem. That's part of reintegrating back into the community.
Thank you, Mr. Schreiner. Do you have any specific language? Have you spoken with legislative council about amendments on this bill?
We could prepare some specific language on that.
Senator Farrioli, your thoughts? I understand. I assume that these, what did you call them, safety avoidance plans?
Chair Brown and members of the committee, that's correct.
Madam Chair, it was just a question of logistics. If the chair regards this as a friendly amendment, I certainly do understand that there are circumstances under which folks under supervision would need some reintegration into their society. And under some strict purview, that certainly might be acceptable. The question I have is if the arts in the drafting, an unambiguous set of amendments that extends the supervision but allows circumstances where those contacts can take place, would be quite an artful amendment to be writing.
Chair Brown, Senator Farrioli, and members of the committee, we could draft that amendment. I do not think that's that difficult because it's often in the language of supervision and treatment with these offenders. So we could draft that. There is one other issue, and I am really only speaking about the folks on supervision. I guess the other issue is what happens for the people that go off of supervision 10, 15 years from now, that now end up with kids, with families. They're not under any supervision. Are they now committing a crime every time they do these kind of things? And who's going to be investigating, prosecuting, and dealing with that? And should that happen? And that's just a question. I know that our part here is to talk about the folks on supervision, but that's another kind of a red flag that came up to us in our discussions.
Okay, so is both I'm talking with the council here, and as we read Section 2, we don't think that deals with what your concern, we don't think the situation arises in Section 2, because you've got a tent criteria there. Section 1 is a little broader, and what you're concerned about is, for example, a sex offender who, under strict supervision or whatever, has the ability to take his child to a park. That's your concern, that would be prohibited under Section 1. Is that sort of the practical implications?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, yes, that would be part of it. And the issue would be if that person has successfully completed treatment or is making great progress in treatment, and they now have children, and it's been determined by polygraphs, risk assessment, all of those things, that they're not a threat. What we end up having is supervised sponsors who work with us. It may be their wife, it may be somebody else that is under the understanding that they'll never be alone with that child. And that has worked. It's not like that has been something that's new. We've been doing it that way for many years with great success.
And can you give me a sense, and I'm sorry, I haven't done this kind of work. Are we talking in terms of sex offenders? Are we talking, you know, maybe 1% of sexually violent ones or predatories who are allowed access to their children under supervised circumstances? Are we talking 10%? I mean, I'm just trying to get a sense.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, I'd be making a guesstimate myself, but I'm not really talking about the sexually violent, dangerous offender. One, that statute is, we're just not getting that many offenders designated that way.
Okay.
And if they've been designated that way, they're probably not going to be having contact. What we are seeing.
Same true for a predatory sex offender.
Predatory sex offenders, we're seeing anywhere from 20 to 25% of the sex offenders in the state of Oregon designated predatory.
Okay.
One of the issues is, and we've acknowledged through this session, and we're continually working on that predatory designation, is there tends to be a bit of an over designation. The people at the highest level, we know that they're predatory, but it is some of those people at that lower end, and very often you're looking at historical behavior. And then through treatment and assessment and looking at sexual deviance and those issues, you see what this person did was terrible. They got the predatory designation, but they're not necessarily somebody that is going to fall out as a sex offender for all of their life, and they can be managed in the community. It's difficult. It's a very challenging art to separate those, and all these predatories tend to be thrown in the same barrel.
Okay. Other questions for Mr. Schreiner? Okay. Thank you. We appreciate you joining us today.
You're welcome.
Anybody else wishing to testify on 3469? All right. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3469. Let's move to 2316. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2316. Ms. Mowad, why don't you tell us about the amendments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The -A3 amendments would replace the bill and extend the statute of limitations for certain felonies based on the victim's age at the time the crime was committed. If the victim was under 18 years of age when the list of crimes, which include rape, sodomy, sexual penetration, sexual abuse, etc., if the victim was under 18 years of age, then current law says that any time before the victim attains 24 years of age or within 6 years after the offense is reported, whichever occurs first, the statute of limitations would run. This bill would increase those limits, and the victim could be up to 30 years of age or within 12 years of the offense if the amendments are adopted.
Thank you. We have a sign-up sheet. No sign-up sheet. Okay, Mr. Hummel, anyone else wishing to testify on this bill? Mr. Schreiner, did you want to come forward? Ms. Washington, that's what I thought. Mr. Washington, it's been a long time. It's good to see you. So far, you've avoided appearances in front of the Senate Rules Committee. That must be a good thing. Mr. Hummel, take it away.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. My name is John Hummel. I'm a criminal defense attorney in Bend, and today I'm representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Our organization is opposed to the -3 amendments. Originally in Oregon, the statute of limitations for sex offenses was 3 years. I think in around 1987, that was extended to 6 years. In approximately 1991, it was extended to any time before the child reaches the age of 24. And there was a good policy reason for that. As everyone knows, an offense occurs against a child. The child doesn't have the maturity level to appreciate the criminality of the conduct, and they might be in a situation of a power imbalance where they're frightened or not able to report it to the police. But by the time they reach the age of 24, they should definitely appreciate the criminality of it and be able to report that. So that made sense. Now before the committee is a proposal to increase the statute of limitations to any time before the child reaches the age of 30, you could have almost a 30-year statute of limitations with that if the child is, you know, 1 year of age or younger during the alleged touching. You know, 29 years later, the defendant could be charged. As time passes, it's just common knowledge that memories fade, evidence disappears. So as you increase statute of limitations, you increase the likelihood that an innocent person will be convicted. And here's an example. If someone is alleged to have touched a little child and they are charged quickly with that offense and they deny it, they're asserting they're innocent. They can say, I didn't touch that girl, and on the day you're telling me I touched that girl, I was in Texas, and I have a witness to tell you I was in Texas, and I have receipts from the hotel to show you I was in Texas. If they're charged 29 years later, their defense in front of the jury is, I didn't touch that girl. I don't know where I was on that date. I have no one who can testify to where I was, and I have no documentation to show that. But I didn't touch her. And they're going to be able to present a less strong defense. That's just common sense. That has to be balanced with the fact of the policy rationale that, you know, a little child is not going to be reporting crimes. That's why we have until the child is 24. I can tell you a real-world example. I represent someone right now, an incident from 1998. A 12-year-old boy is alleged to have touched a neighbor girl. The touching eventually came to light. Chair Brown?
A 12-year-old boy in 1998 was alleged to have touched
Chair Brown, 1988.
Okay.
12-year-old boy is alleged to have touched a neighbor girl.
Okay.
Eventually came to light. The parents knew. The child was put into counseling, went to church counseling. The child wrote letters of apology to the girl and her family. Everyone knew about it. The child got counseling, got help, has lived a productive life, never involved with the law, has raised a family, is married, has a good job. In June of 2005, word got to the police about this touching. The neighbor girl is in her early 20s, not 24 yet. Man is charged with 5 felony sex abuse counts, and we're defending that now. Now, that still, the child was before the age of 24, so we have some problems from a defense perspective. But the details of the crime, it's one thing to say touching occurred, and you know, he confessed to touching occurring. He wrote the letter. We have the letter. He said, I apologize for touching. But what type of touching? Different types of touching leads to different severities of crime. And you try to remember what level of touching occurred back then, and it's quite difficult. Here's how I want to sum it up, if I could. This is a very complicated area of the law, and there are lots of policy considerations that go into it, balancing the rights of victims with the rights of the innocent. And my understanding is that Senator Burdick and Representative Krieger are quite interested in doing some interim committee work on all of our sex offenses, taking a holistic look at it. When you piecemeal it out in the final days of session, there could be some unintended consequences. And you have my word from my organization that this is not a stalling tactic technique. If we do put this to an interim committee, we would love to come to the table and look at it from a holistic point of view and probably give a bit on things and not just be at the committee saying no, no, no. So we would urge the committee to not take action on this and send this to an interim group. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Washington or Mr. Schreiner, who would like to go next?
Madam Chair, Members of the committee, my name is Michael Washington, and I'm chair of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. And I'm not here to testify on the A3 amendments regarding House Bill 2316, but as it's listed on the agenda here, and House Bill 2316A, requiring that designation of a person as predatory sex offender be based solely on application of the sex offender risk assessment scale that's approved by the Department of Corrections. This amendment in the House bill came about based on the Oregon Supreme Court's ruling in VLY versus the Board of Parole this past year. And in that ruling, it addressed the board's process and how it designated offenders as predatory sex offenders. And it addressed whether or not the offenders that were being subject to this designation should have a due process, a right to contest the predatory designation. In the statute, ORS 181585, it defined a predatory sex offender as a person who presently exhibited the characteristics showing a tendency to victimize or injure others. In the opinion by the Supreme Court, it indicated that the board would not be able to use the fact that the offender has a conviction for sex crimes and that prior behavior as a basis for showing that the offender presently exhibited those characteristics once the offender was released from custody. And if that were the case, with the board's inability to establish any additional evidence to show that the offender is presently exhibiting those characteristics, they would be unable to designate an offender as predatory under the statute. So the board is moving to ask this committee to pass the amendment of ORS 181585 to remove that definition of a predatory sex offender and require under the Section 2 of that same statute that it be mandated that any offender that has a particular score on the risk assessment scale that's approved by the Department of Corrections be designated as a predatory sex offender. This amendment would allow the board to continue its designation and its current procedures as it does now. And without the passing of this, there will be an inability on the part of the board to designate offenders as predatory. And if the board is unable to designate those sex offenders that should be predatory, then there will be no mechanism on the part of community corrections to notify the community of those offenders' presence in the community.
Okay, thank you. Say hi to our colleague, Senator Hannon. And who is the third member of the?
Darcy Baker.
Okay, great. Mr. Schreiner, what would you like to share with us again this afternoon?
Chair Brown and members of the committee, I'm still Pat Schreiner with the Marion County Sheriff's Office. And once again, I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Correction Directors and the Sex Offender Supervision Network. I would really like to concur with Pro Board Chair Michael Washington's assessment and issues. Those are our issues. I will say that the VLY decision has ground to a halt predatory designations. I believe since February 10th, there are not any sex offenders coming out of prison that are being designated predatory. So the result is we're not statewide. We're not drafting community notification plans. We're not looking at how we could notify the community about the most high-risk dangerous offenders coming out because we lack the mechanism to do that. 2316 in its original version gave us those tools to deal with that issue. I agree with Mr. Hummel. I have been pretty active and testified a lot through this session on a variety of sex offender bills. I think we need that interim joint judiciary committee to really take a look at this. I will tell you that I've been involved with 2050, 3486, I mean the website, the Living Close to Victims, and a variety of other bills. Frankly, I think this one is the most important for community supervision of all the sex offender bills, and I find it very disturbing that this bill seems to be falling off the table.
Thank you, Mr. Schreiner. Questions for the panel? Sarah Shields.
I guess I'm wanting to make this a little more real, and I hope I'm not making it too real, but if you have a person who, when they were 20, 25 years old.
We're back to the amendments.
No.
So, Mr. Hummel, I think
are
that's
you back
you.
To the amendments?
Well, if you're going to ask about 20 or 25 years old, you're back to the amendments.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
Because I see the bill itself as important.
Okay.
All right. At that point in time, they committed a rape. They were under the influence of drugs and all kinds of stuff, real messed up. They go to prison 15 years. They're maybe up for boot camp or something that reduces their sentence a little bit. They're ready to go out into the community. How does this tool work in defining? I mean, if say they were a model prisoner and everything else, how does this designation based on risk assessment scale approved by the department, how does that all work? I mean, we all see the word sex offender, or we see the term that somebody committed a rape and has gone to prison for rape, and it seems to me they all go in one category. That's intellectually, that's probably not true. Probably some of them did something very bad 20 years ago and went through a program and went through a boot camp and came out very different people. How does this assessment tool really work? I guess what I'm trying to drive at. Neither one of you want to do it.
Chair Brown, Senator Shields, and members of the committee, the static 99 is the current tool we're using. The offender you described may or may not score as predatory. If this is their one and only sexual offense, when you do that assessment, it's very possible that that person would not score as predatory. One of the factors that is weighted in that tool is more than one conviction for sexual offending behavior. That person will more likely score as predatory. So we use polygraphs, and full disclosure polygraphs are a big part of the way we do business, which gives us a really a more extensive history. On a sex offender, we know they tend to be secretive and deny history. So one of the things that happens when they're in treatment is we get that full history, and very often that might indicate that their risk is greater. Also, when they start telling the truth, we also know that they're not keeping the secrets. So that's a factor that moves in the other way, and so you're balancing these issues. It's not a simple answer, but the risk assessment tool we have, it's not perfect. There's flaws to that risk assessment tool. I just mentioned when I was testifying a minute ago that we tend to be over-designating some people, particularly young offenders who have not been in a relationship for more than 2 years. We know we need to address that, and that is one of our interests in the interim session. However, right now, we're not able to assess them at all, and we can assess them, and that tool is the best tool, not only nationally, internationally right now. It's it's an actuarial risk assessment tool that's been standardized and validated.
So it attempts to be as objective as versus subjective as possible.
Chair Brown, Senator Shields, and members of the community, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, the only thing I would want to add to that is that during the course of the incarceration of most of these offenders, they're not receiving any sex offender treatment, so they're coming out as untreated people.
And Mr. Washington, and that's because the Oregon legislature doesn't fund sex offender treatment programs in our Oregon state prison system. Isn't that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Thank you. Somebody doesn't, and since we're funding the program.
What about Sutter Creek? Don't they do any?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, there are no sex offender treatment programs in the Department of Corrections at this time.
We make choices, Sarah Shields.
Bad ones sometimes.
That's correct. I'm well aware of some of the bad choices we make. Mr. Hummel, can I go back to the Dash A3 amendments? I think what I'm struggling with a little bit in terms of your argument, number one is I can't remember what the limit is in terms of civil cases on these child sex abuse cases, but basically unlimited or at least till a child becomes, I'm going to say, about this time frame. And I understand that the burden of proof is different and whatever, but I don't know, with all due respect to my colleague who's from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, I don't know how a state, how the DA's office could actually bring evidence in the case that you're talking about that would anywhere rise to the level needed for a conviction under this proposal.
And that letter would help.
Yeah, the letter certainly would help, but...
Chair Brown, thank you for the question. Here is the dilemma that a defendant is faced with. As the state increases penalties for sex abuse offenses, and as we add other consequences such as lifetime sex offender registration, a prosecutor, even with...
Which we aren't doing right now, or at least not predatory sex offender.
A prosecutor, even with less than overwhelming evidence, or shall we even say weak evidence, can say to a defendant, we've charged you with 10 felony sex abuse cases. If you lose, we're going to try to put you away for 8 years. But if you plead guilty, we'll just give you a 6-month sentence. Of course, you'll have to register as a sex offender for life. That innocent person is faced with this decision. Well, I'm innocent. I think their evidence is weak. I can go to trial, and I think I can win a trial, but I could lose. And if I lose, I'm doing 8 years in prison. Or do I take the 6 months as a for risk for damage control? Mm-hmm. So you will often find that the weaker a prosecution's case, the more likely they are to give an enticing plea offer because they fear if they go to trial they'll lose. So that's the problem that an innocent person faces.
That's very helpful. And the other, the case you raised, the child that committed the crime was extremely young. That's the other thing that's sort of troubling about that case. If this proposal required that the perpetrator be over the age of 18 at the time the crime was allegedly committed, does that alleviate some of your concerns? I mean, because really what we're focused on, I think, is adults who are sexually committing sexual offending crimes on children, right? I mean, that would be my sense of what the gist of this is.
Chair Brown, I agree with that. I'm actually doing a legislative history on that. It seems to me that that was the aim all along of the legislature, to focus on the adult people, and once the child victim reaches the age of majority, they will have the intellectual capability to report. So you are correct. That would be much helpful. The one concern I do have, though, 24 seemed like an appropriate age in 1997. 30 might seem the appropriate age now. 34 next session, or 40? Why not 60? These ages are arbitrary, and we agreed on 24. I think an interim committee could decide, you know, what is the appropriate age? And let's decide that and put these piecemeal bills to bed that we see every session.
I think you raise a really good issue. I think we've struggled in prior legislatures with the whole repressed memory. I think there's a number of primarily women, but I'm sure there's men out there as well. I mean, we've got a whole situation happening with the Catholic Church of children who were sexually abused and don't even remember until after the age of 30. And I think for a number of women, it's not till even after the age of 40. I think you raise some good points. Any questions for Mr. Hummel on the Dash A3s? Thank you. Mr. Pedanke, did you want to come testify about the A3s?
Madam Chair, I wanted to, since the other two witnesses had addressed the original bill, with your indulgence, I would like to address the original bill and the reasons why the ACLU, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, and the Oregon Psychological Association were opposed to the original House Bill 2316.
It overturns an Oregon Supreme Court case, correct?
It's a creative way to try to make that make two Oregon Supreme Court decisions irrelevant. And the VLY case was an ACLU case. The issue in the VLY case was due process. There's nothing in the VLY decision that prevents the Board of Post-Parole and Post-Prison Supervision from designating people as predatory sex offenders as long as they provide those offenders with an opportunity for a hearing to challenge the factual basis for that designation. The problem with the Static 99 risk assessment tool is that it's not perfect. It is objective, but it is both over-inclusive and under-inclusive in terms of sweeping in offenders and not sweeping in offenders. I think Mr. Schreiner's testimony today has been very clear, and I hope educational for all of you, that there are too many people currently being designated as predatory sex offenders. If House Bill 2316A engrossed is approved, there will not only continue to be too many people being designated as predatory, but some people who should be designated as predatory won't be.
I'm being told to have you identify yourself for the
I'm sorry.
Keep going.
David Fedanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. We believe the answer is to provide an opportunity for due process hearings for these offenders rather than trying to get around the two clear decisions by the Oregon Supreme Court that due process hearings are required. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair and other members of the committee.
Further questions? Any other folks wishing to add testimony to the record on this issue? Now we're going to close the public hearing on this bill, and then we're going to move to the two forestry-related bills, House Bill 2122B and House Bill 2327. May I have the sign-up sheets for those, please? We're going to open up the public hearing on 2122B. I call Charlie Stone and Marianne Guest. This guest may have just stepped out for a minute, so we'll begin with Mr. Stone.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Charlie Stone with the Forestry Department. I'm not sure I can tap dance long enough for her to get back here. I believe the Forestry Department has already testified in an earlier hearing on this bill. I just wanted to make myself available and understand that with the changes to the budget here recently, there's less money needed in the forest practices portion of the harvest tax under this. The bill was the A engrossed? Yes, the B engrossed bill shows 59 cents rate for the support of the Forest Practices Act, and I believe that's going to be proposed to be lowered to 55 cents. We've done the calculations that will fund the Forest Practices Act at the level that the proposed budget is at, and just want to be available for questions.
Thank you for that clarification. And would staff look and see if Ms. Guest is in the hallway?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr.
Mayor, some questions.
Senator Ringo has questions.
Thank you, Mr. Stone. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the revenue impact, and I'm wondering if maybe this is the revenue impact before the amendments. Is that what's going on here?
Frankly, Senator Ringo, I'd have to look at it and study. I'm a last-minute replacement because all of our folks are over at the Board of Forestry meeting at in Central Oregon right now. But if it ends up with a 59-cent rate, then I would say, yes, it's the old.
Okay. It is the old one because this is dated June 27th.
Yes.
And I am curious,
June 28th version.
A June 28th?
In the lower left-hand corner, 728.
Oh.
It shows a reduction of $1.64 million.
That's what I have.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would still be the old calculation.
It would still be the old one.
Yeah, under the agreement on the budgets, there's an additional reduction made to the Forest Practices Program under and below the governor's recommended budget, therefore less harvest tax money needed to run the program, and I believe very recent calculations suggest that instead of 59 cents it would be 55 cents necessary to support the biennial budget.
I see, and is this tax rate set for just a short period of time? It's not, I mean,
it's set for a year
fluctuate
period.
Based on how much money we need.
Chair Ferrioli, Senator Ringo, each session it gets set for the next 2 years, they look at the ending balance for the fund, what they want to have as an ending balance at the end of the next 2 years, the projected harvest for that two-year period, and the budget. And so it always waits till the end of the session until we have a budget, and then they calculate the need to generate that much revenue.
Thank you. And just to follow up, and the reason in the relating clause it says requires a three-fifths majority is because this may have been lower than the previous harvest tax, since that would have expired, in essence, is a new tax.
That's correct. There would be no rate collected if the bill didn't pass.
Right. Okay. Thank
Good
you.
Good question, Senator. Thank you for the clarifications, Mr. Stone.
Welcome.
Ms. Guest, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In regards to House Bill 2122, we'd like to talk about it in context of the other bill, too, that's before you, House Bill 2327, the fire cost bill. And what we would like is 2122 currently at this point, as it is in front of your committee, reduces the forest products harvest tax by 20 cents. And we would suggest that you increase that back to where it was by 20 cents per thousand and dedicate those money to fire suppression to decrease the impact on the general fund for fire suppression on private land.
Questions? Thank you, ma'am. Nobody else has signed up for 2122B, so we'll close the public hearing on that and open the public hearing on 2327. And, yes, why don't you just lead off since you're also signed up for that testimony.
Do you want me to start off?
Yes, please. Well, we'll bring Mr. Stone up in a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Marianne Guest representing the Wild Salmon Center, and we're not opposed necessarily to House Bill 2327 itself. We're opposed to the funding mechanism and the cost shift to the general fund of $10 million. I would like to, you know, there's been a lot of discussion around this bill and the cost shift of $10 million to the general fund, and I'd like for the record to point out that if this bill does not pass, it is true that there will be, it'll cost the general fund more money. And the reason that is in 2003 legislature, the legislature sunsetted the increase to $15 million for fire suppression insurance. Since they sunsetted that amount, it will declined to $10 million, which then would, without this bill, the private sector will be paying less dollars, and the general fund may have to come up with the dollars to fight fire suppression. And so, we need this bill. There is no doubt about that. But we also believe that the money is there, it exists already, and that you shouldn't put this burden on the general fund when we're fighting for money for health care, for education, for senior services. This is not the time to cost shift the cost for fire suppression on private lands to the general fund. There are other options. One of them was 2122 that we just discussed. And the other option is that you could use part of the money of the tax, the forest products harvest tax, that is dedicated to the Oregon Forest Resources Institute. You could use a portion of those dollars and shift them for fire suppression. I think everybody in this building has had to make tough decisions. And we've got a tough decision right now. And the private sector does, too. The timber companies have a tough decision. But I would think it would be more prudent on the part of the legislature to use existing tax dollars that the private sector is paying on this, on the timber, rather than cost shifting to the general fund.
Questions from the panel? Thank you. I'd like to bring up Mr. Stone and Mr. Wilkinson. And Ms. McNitt. All are signed up on our sheet. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Charlie Stone for the Department of Forestry. House Bill 2327 came about really with its start in the 2001-2002 fire seasons. You recall we spent an awful lot of money suppressing fires in those 2 years. We had claims against the one-of-a-kind insurance policy that the state has for fire costs of $4 million and $19 million in those two fire seasons. And by the time the 2003 fire season, or excuse me, legislative session, maybe they're about the same thing.
Yeah.
by the time the 2003 legislative session rolled around, we were faced with great uncertainty as to whether we could even get an insurance policy for 2003. Ultimately, we were able to, but the deductible was greater than it had been in the past. The coverage was lower. The cost was higher. Not a good situation. And so we were looking at trying to figure out how to make the fire funding system in the state sustainable for the next several years. Ultimately, no long-term agreements were reached in 2003, but House Bill 2301 allowed us to patch together a system that got us through the last 2 years, and most of the key, if not all, the elements in that bill have either sunset or will sunset during this biennium. The upshot is that without House Bill 2327, there's the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund is allowed to spend up to $10 million, the first $10 million of emergency fire costs. And we have an insurance policy for the 2005 fire season and the intent to continue this into the future if it works out with a $25 million deductible. The reason that we went to that much higher deductible is because the premiums, the premium saving is significant. Instead of in comparison to a $15 million deductible, we save $2.1 million in the premium each year. And if you project that out over a 10-year period, that savings in premiums is greater than the amount that the general fund would likely spend in filling the gap between the OFLPF at a $15 million level and the insurance. Now, I know I'm rolling out a whole lot of numbers here, but this bill was the result of a work group that worked through the interim, balanced in terms of Senate and House participation, both parties, landowners, budget analysts, the Department of Forestry folks, and they came up with this solution as the most cost-effective way to provide future forest protection. The bill does raise the exposure or the responsibility of the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, which is fully funded by landowner contributions, assessments, and tax payments, from $10 million to $15 million. It takes a situation currently where there's no requirement after 2301 sunsets for insurance or for anybody to pay for that insurance, and says that the landowners will pay up to half of that through the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. It increases the reserve base of the fund from $15 million to $22.5 million, at which point the collections of the landowners reduce by half, but they continue until it reaches $30 million, and make sure that there's money in the fund available to pay that $15 million annual exposure. And then it takes care of a few other minor elements in fire funding, things like making sure that credits and debits are carried forward in the district budgets, et cetera. It also requires the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund to pay back half of this year's premium that has been currently paid entirely from the general fund. So that would be a $645,000 return to the general fund if the bill passes. There's an element of other piece of the bill that deals with restricting jurisdictional firefighting agencies from prohibiting landowners from protecting their own land, come along and say, okay, we're here, go away, you don't need to be here anymore. And to that, I raise that point primarily because I believe Ms. McNitt is going to propose a B4 amendment to the bill. I just want to say that the Department of Forestry is quite fine with that amendment if you should choose to bring it forward. I think those are the key points. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is everybody else testifying?
No, sorry. Mr. Wilkerson is next. And then,
okay, you just started. All right. Mr. Wilkerson, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council, representing forest landowners. As Mr. Stone indicated, this bill is a product of a work group that met extensively during the last interim in response to a budget note from the last legislature. And OFIC, I was represented on that work group, and it was a very thoughtful process dealing with a very serious issue, and came out with a very good product in our view, and we support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. McNitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. We, too, had a place at the table during the interim on the infamous budget note number 3 task force. We met about every 3 weeks. There was considerable input by many legislators, including colleagues from your own chamber. We support the bill, and we also support the Dash 4 amendments, which staff has provided to you. They're short amendments. I passed out a one-page hand-engrossed version of page 2, and basically what it does is section 4 on page 2 says that the state forester or any agency or organization with responsibility to suppress fires may not prohibit an owner or an owner's agent from suppressing the fire occurring on the owner's property, and then it provides two exceptions to that. The first exception is when the owner or agent conducts an action in a manner that the forester agency or organization reasonably determines is likely to increase the risk of injury or damage to the personnel or equipment of the forester agency or organization, and we're supportive of that. The second exception is one that we would just like to strike. I think for all practical purposes, everyone recognizes that during a fire event, there are decisions that are made among agencies and landowners about how to manage the fire, where to draw a fire line, a break, and you have to move on. But to specifically have in statute that the state forester or an agency and organization fighting fires can remove the landowner from their own land is of some concern. So we drafted these amendments after the House hearing and just had them ready in the wings. I don't believe there's any opposition to that. In fact, I'm not sure the language was necessary to begin with. So we're hopeful that you can be supportive of the Dash B4s.
Okay. Questions from the panel? Sarah Ringo.
Thank you. Who was on the work group? I know you were. I know she was. I know you were.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, the legislators that were involved, the chair of the group was Representative Susan Morgan, and then Representatives Krupp, Krieger, Hobson, and then Representative Johnson. There were Senators Schrader, Ferrioli, Metzger, and Senator Westland was named to the committee, but didn't actually end up participating.
Okay. And I'm curious why the language that Christina wants now to delete, why that was apparently agreed upon by the work group.
She's kind of shaking her head no.
If I might, Senator Ringo, actually that was not the product of the work group initially was to simply put in the prohibition on removing landowners from their land. During the process in the House, some of the municipal and rural fire departments had some concerns about the provision. They felt that it might cause them to not be able to make the stand at the right place. Forest Park in Portland was used as an example where they might felt they might have to sacrifice a couple of front row lots in order to make a stand and fight the fire at the right place. Didn't want to have those homeowners in there doing battle with them, so to speak, saying, no, we've got to save our home. We fixed that in an amendment. Oh, excuse me, Senator.
Well, I mean, that concept that you're describing sounds fine to me, but on the sub B, it as currently written, it says they must balance the value to the public interest, and that's being deleted. What's the impact of that,
Senator Ringo? I think the real impact is none, because as I was going to point out, that what we did we did kind of a belt and suspenders approach to this. First, we changed it so that this provision only applied to agencies with responsibilities under Chapter 477. So basically, that's the Forestry Department and the Forest Protective Associations. The cities and the rurals don't operate under Chapter 477. So it already gives them free reign to do what they feel they have to do, making B basically unnecessary from their point of view anyway.
Well, I wasn't in the work group and I don't have good knowledge of this, but it seems to me that we're empowering the landowner here to have some decision making over their own land, and to me that's a good thing. But there's an issue as to balancing the public interest. And are we not removing that balance? And that's the same question, and I guess maybe I didn't understand your answer.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I'll try. I think that the current way that we do business balances that interest anyway. We're in a large fire situation. As we're making the plans for the next day, for the next shift, we're generally speaking with the landowner. We're talking about, okay, if we try to make the stand here, you know, our chance might be 30-40%. If we fall back to this road, you know, we'll have a 90% chance of holding the fire. That means we're going to have to allow it to burn through your property. We have those discussions and we try to work it out. That's the balancing of the public interest issue.
Okay.
Can we actually stop the fire and hold it, save some dollars in doing it, and that type of thing? And in the same situation, if the fire's moving fast and we're on initial attack or it's just blowing up on us, we're not making those. We're not bringing anybody else into it. We're making the decision. We're moving. We're going fast, but for the most part, we're trying to do that anyway.
Okay, thank you. And maybe a question for Ray, or any of you, I guess. We don't know how severe the fire season will be. If it is a severe fire season, essentially this bill will create a $10 million hit to the general fund. Do I read that right?
Senator Ringo, if it's a severe fire season and the entire deductible is used up, and we get into the policy itself, the deductible is $25 million. The landowners will be responsible for the first 15, and the general fund would be responsible for the last 10.
Okay, and does that obligation to the general fund then, does that trigger automatically upon the costs exceeding $15 million?
Senator Ringo, that's correct.
Okay. I'm curious as to the policy reason why we would subsidize the management costs, in this case fire suppression, for private landowners, particularly in light of the forest industry's participation in Measure 37, which essentially said, government, leave us alone. And essentially, you know, it's our land, stay away from our land, don't infringe on our rights. And yet here, this is a potential subsidy of $10 million.
Senator Ringo, I'm not sure I grasp the connection to Measure 37, but let me comment more generally, if I could, on your question. There's two reasons why, in our view, it's appropriate to have a shared responsibility for this program. One is that a substantial number of fires are caused by the general public, and the second is that there's a substantial number of public resources at risk from fire, as well as private resources. The public resources, for instance, water quality and wildlife habitat, to name two.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd like to also answer the earlier question, and really not meaning to parse words, but when we talk about the general fund being responsible for that $10 million gap, House Bill 2327 doesn't create that situation. That exists. In fact, it was. You have to go back to 1991 when the legislature placed a $10 million limit on the amount that the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund would pay. The general fund has always been exposed beyond that, with the exception that there's insurance. And then it was the choice to raise the insurance deductible that causes that, and the existing legislation. 2327 really closes that gap a little bit.
Okay, thank you.
Sarah Shields.
I just want to follow up on that. This creates the $10 million, but over the years, what has the general fund hit been since? Can you give us a series of years?
I sure can, Madam Chair, Senator Shields. If you go back prior to 1989, as far as emergency firefighting costs are concerned, they were always the responsibility of the landowner under the system, the way that it worked. 1987 was probably the worst fire season that we'd had in the last 50 years. Didn't quite match the costs of 2002, but that's because of inflation and other factors. But in 1987, we spent $30 million, or the equivalent of that, fighting fires. And at that time, the system as it was designed provided $2 million from the landowners and $2 million in insurance. And so after the 1987 fire season, the legislature stepped in and the emergency board provided, and I don't remember the numbers exactly, it was either $13 or $15 million. So that's the first time that the general fund stepped in and paid a big chunk. In 1989 and in 1991, the system was looked at and revised and created basically what we're dealing with today. And during that period of time, there have been three different years when the emergency fire costs were paid all out of the fund or the insurance, but because of the limit to the landowner's fund, the general fund stepped in to buy the insurance premium for the next year, and the total over those 3 years was $9 million something.
So it was $3 million a year average in 89, 90, 91?
No, they were... They were following the 92 fire season, the 94 fire season, and the 2001 fire season. Those were each big years, and because of the $10 million limit on the OFLPF, all that $10 million was spent on firefighting, none left to pay for the insurance, and so the general fund of the emergency board paid for the insurance next year.
Okay, but what I guess I'm driving at is, up till now, except for that 1 year in 87 where the general fund paid for $15 million worth. In these other years that you've just referenced, it's $3 million.
That's correct.
There's never been another year where it approached $10 million or anything like that in since 91?
No, sir. But the costs have been going up each year, and this is looking out into the future and what we expect. Based on the last 10 years, if you project those forward, inflated, and project those forward, we would think that that there might be three out of the next 10 years when costs would exceed the $15 million that the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund would pay. Out of those 3 years, only one would exceed $25 million and go into insurance. So there'd be a $10 million exposure, one out of 10 years for the emergency board. And in the other 2 years, $1 to $4 million, somewhere in that range. And as I mentioned before, the savings in insurance premium is greater than that exposure if we have similar experience to the last 20 years.
Okay. Senator Ferrioli.
The exposure to the general fund in several of the low fire danger years has been zero.
That's correct.
And routinely we have the discussion at the end of the legislative session, kind of a tea leaf reading session about what we think the fire season might be. And normally there's a discussion around what level of reservation to make within the emergency board fund for firefighting emergency services. And isn't that normally $10 million? Don't we talk about the parameters in those general terms?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, frankly, I've not been involved in the number setting for those years, but what Ken Rocco, legislative fiscal officer, has told us on a number of occasions is they don't spend emergency board money until they know what the fire season's going to do. So basically the reserve, they look first to see what we're going to do for fires, and that's, you know, one of the reasons that the EPOT exists. And so, yes, that is taken into account. And we've also asked for, through the budget and through the agreement, are going to receive, as a special purpose appropriation, I believe, a $2 million appropriation that would allow us to pre-stage equipment. That's part of the focus of this bill, is to have severity money, is what we call it, to pre-stage helicopters, crews, engines, when we see a lightning event coming or when the weather is very extreme, to again try to keep the fires small and keep us out of those 10, 15, et cetera, millions of dollars of cost, and keep them down in the hundreds of thousands, keep those fires small. And that's what this bill is really all about.
And last comment, Madam Chair.
Senator Farrelly.
Can you just discuss for a brief moment our obligations under our cooperative fire management agreements with federal and special district and other agencies besides state agencies?
Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, in very general terms, there's the Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, all the various rural fire departments. In virtually all cases, we have mutual aid agreements with those organizations where we go help them fight the fire in the initial attack stage. They help us fight the fire in the initial attack stage, and no money is exchanged. If the fire gets beyond that, then we have agreements. In the case of the rurals and all that, we basically pay their rates to use their equipment and their people. If the fires are on our jurisdiction, which generally overlap with the rurals, with the Forest Service and the BLM, well, BLM's two different cases because we protect the Western Oregon BLM. It's treated just like private land. But elsewhere, the grazing lands in Eastern Oregon and the Forest Service, if it's on their land, then they pay us to come help. If it's on our land, we pay them to come help at the cost that we incur.
So, Madam Chair, I guess the thing I would assert here is that the public purpose for this fund is so that we can fully participate in cooperative fire suppression agreements, provide a backstop for landowners in our 50-50 agreement with fire suppression assessments for them, and also just to make sure that we're able to do aggressive initial attack and slap down fires wherever they occur, no matter how big the fire season gets. So, Madam Chair, I think those are pretty substantial public purpose issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you. Madam Fiscal Analyst, would you please come either to the dais or...
Yes, the dais.
The dais. Yes. This is your chance to ask your question, Senator Ringo.
Thank you very much. I think I had it answered, but I will ask.
They were on House Bill 2122?
Yes, I understand.
Public hearing on House Bill 2122.
Thank you for coming. I was just trying to understand what the updated revenue impact statement is. And I have the one that is down in the left-hand corner. It says 728, but the numbers were a little bit different. And is there an updated revenue statement?
I can appreciate your confusion, Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, because I caught the difference myself in looking at the A and gross version versus the B. And what I did was give you the difference, and I probably should have given you a different number, but I gave you the difference between what I had projected you'd get under the previous rates and what you would get when you drop that rate from 0.79 to 0.59. So that's not really how to approach this kind of a bill, I think. You know, I'm used to doing negative impacts on revenue statements, and I'm expecting a loss. But when you have a sunset date, right?
Yes.
And you're putting this in, so you can look at it as this is the net. This is the difference. This marginal loss you're going to get when you have this reduction in that rate, but well, in effect, with
Madam, no, I follow you on that, and I think that was that made sense to me, but. But my understanding from the testimony, it was going down to 55 cents. And this says 59.
I thought it was going down to 59 cents, but
okay.
It might be just a technical error on my part, but all I did was really factor that number
Mr.
down.
Forrester, come on up.
I may have misunderstood that.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, no, you didn't misunderstand.
And for the record, your name is?
For the record, I'm Charlie Stone, again, with the Department of Forestry. When we heard that 2122 was up today, I called Clark Seeley, our associate state forester, who's been working with this bill. He's at the Board of Forestry meeting over in Central Oregon. He said that Susie Jordan with LFO had worked with them and had prepared some changes, which I've not seen here yet today, but that because of the budget agreement that just was reached on Monday, the amount that is needed for the Forest Practices Act was less, and that rather than the 59 cents that's in the B and Gross bill, that LFO would be bringing in a 55 cent rate to insert in the bill. But I don't have the documentation to substantiate that.
Madam Chair, I mean, that's fine. It just seems to me that then this is slightly inaccurate because of the change, but only by a small percent.
That's correct.
Okay. That's fine. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
You can be excused. Thank you very much.
Okay. Anybody else wanting to testify on House Bill 2122? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2122, close the public hearing on 2327. We will not move either one of those at this time. I need to check Ms. McNitt's amendments on 2327. Once we finish up Senate Bill 1041, which I hope we're going to be able to do, I don't know where Mr. Cruz is, we are going to recess, not adjourn, so we can come back after floor session, because I know I miss you all, and when I don't spend hours with you every day, I get very sad.
We're sorry about that, too.
We get very sad. So where did Mr. Cruz go?
He's just probably in the hall. Is there something
okay.
Madam Chair, will we have a new list of bills for after the floor
session? Possibly. It might be small list. I'd like to try and get these bills done that we are working on today. I know that folks want some amendments to 3469 and the other House bill. Senate Bill 10, let's open a work session on Senate Bill 1041.
Oh, we're doing it.
Yeah, let's do it.
Oh.
That's why I was looking for Mr. Cruz.
I just told him we were going to do it.
Oh.
Before session.
Oh.
I thought that's what you wanted to do.
Oh, I didn't know we'd have the amendments ready.
Yes.
Can you walk us through the amendments?
I can.
Okay.
I think it would be a good idea to have the other people
okay.
present at the negotiation.
Let's
but
go,
I'm happy
see,
to.
Why don't you go get them and we'll
yes.
stand at ease for
and
a couple
I'll
of minutes.
First.
Let's go off the record for. Back on the record, we're public hearing on Senate Bill 1041. We are in subcommittee. We are still in subcommittee. Thank you, Mr. Gilliam. We appreciate your services to the state of Oregon and the Oregon legislature. Mr. Cruz, Ms. Hebb, tell us about the Dash 10 amendments to Senate Bill 1041.
Why don't you go ahead? I'm
okay.
Defer to the lawyer.
Okay. Don't be nice. We don't have time for nice.
This is Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center, and I think I can explain the substantive difference between the Dash 10 amendments and the Dash 7 amendments, which were last considered by the committee. The Dash 10s do two things. One is they add in subsection 6 of Section 1, they clarify that the affirmative defense that exists for victims of domestic violence and other people who were in danger such that they were that they took these actions, it clarifies that defense is also available to third parties who were in a position such that they had to offer shelter to someone who was in danger. And so I think that was the original intent, if I understand correctly, of the affirmative defense, and it needed to be clarified. So that's what that subsection 6 does. Subsection 8, which is on page 3 of the amendments, is where there is a second change. And that change indicates that the court's authority to order the parties to obtain counseling is conditioned upon a showing that there's good cause and that it is appropriate to make that order. So those are the two changes. I don't know if Mr. Cruz has anything to add.
Those are the changes.
Senator Brown, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sean Cruz, Senator Gordley's legislative aide. What we wanted to see happen was that in these cases, every party has probably never done this before. You know, no one has had a history of abducting a child. No one has had a history of having their child abducted. So everybody's in this process for the first time. And what we wanted to build into this bill were protections for the child victims first, but not forget the other victims that are there. And to have this vehicle as an alternative to... you may file criminal charges, but you may decide not to go through with that if that's going to do further damage to your family. And we wanted to make sure that some counseling professional, someone with experience in this area, is in the case from the beginning, as close to the beginning as we can get.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I appreciate you both working on this. I think the changes are good legal improvements to the bill. So any questions? We're now in full committee. Any questions for these two? Great. Let's close public hearing. Open the work session. Chair would move the -10 amendments to Senate Bill 1041. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move the bill as amended at the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you. Senator Gordley, would you be willing to carry? All right. Thank you. And don't leave my two, please. We're going to thank you. You guys can leave, not these two can't leave. Let's open a public hearing on, work session on House Bill 3129. Chair would move -A2 amendments to House Bill 3129. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Just a bit, Madam Chair.
Sure.
I'm regularly pilloried for mandating curriculum to school districts, and I will be voting yes in committee today to assist the chair to move this forward.
Thank you very much for your courtesies. I appreciate that fact, especially since I can't seem to track down Senator Ringo or Senator, I was going to say Senator Ringo Starr, Senator Atkinson. Thank you very much. Chairs move the bill
so
as amended.
Without objection, Madam Chair.
Without objection. The motion is carried. Thank you for your courtesy vote, Senator Farrioli. Senator Walker will carry the bill. And we are in recess until following floor session to see if we can 5:30. Recess till 5:30. Thank you. Your continuation of your July 28th Committee on Rules. It's my understanding that we were unable to get amendments on House Bill 2316 or 2469. Hopefully we can hear those. Did I say 2469? 3469. We'll hear those tomorrow. We're also waiting anxiously on the amendments to House Bill 2157. We'll hear that tomorrow. We took care of Senate Bill 680. Senate Bill 1041 have been taken care of. We did move House Bill 3129. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Farrioli, for your courtesy vote. Let's open a public hearing, hear from Senator Corder and, and Mr. Johnson, if anybody has any questions. And then we'll proceed to move, assuming we got our act together on the other two House bills, we'll proceed to move those. All right. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2070. Senator Carter, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson, you just want to do a technical walkthrough of the amendments?
That's why I invited him, Mr. Chairman. Madam Chairman.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, do you want me to proceed with that first?
I'm sorry. That'd be great.
Okay.
If the Senator doesn't mind.
Not at all. I ask him for that first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office. I guess to begin, let me talk a little bit conceptually about what the amendment as a whole does. 1997 ballot measure 50 established permanent rate limits that apply to all taxing districts. There was an exception in that limitation for certain kinds of bonded debt that everyone calls gap bonds. that measure also in the Constitution said that the rate limit that it establishes is increased when these gap bonds are retired. That is actually the situation that occurred with respect to some Portland School District gap bonds. They were retired as of 2003. And as a result of that, the permanent rate limit for the Portland School District was increased. As you're probably aware, there's an interaction between the state school fund grant and property tax, local property tax revenues. So that when a school district's property taxes increase, in fact, their state school fund grant normally decreases by a corresponding amount. In 2003, the legislature modified the state school fund distribution so that the state school fund grant would not increase by the amount by which the Portland School District permanent rate limit, permanent rate increased as a result of the retirement of gap bonds. That was, however, just a two-year provision. The amendment you have before you basically extends that for an additional 2 years so that the property tax rate of the school district will go up and the state school fund distribution to the district will not go down by a corresponding amount. Turning to the amendment specifically, that change in the state school fund distribution formula is in section 4, actually on page 5 of the amendment. The bolded material you see there is the language that allows the state school fund grant to remain as it otherwise would be without a reduction. Section 4A, I'd like to highlight because that is a part of it. It's just kind of been a recent issue with this amendment. That expressly states that the state school fund distribution amendment applies to fiscal years beginning July 1, 2005. So that this will apply retroactively based on whenever it becomes law to the 2005 fiscal year. Section 5 basically deletes the changes to the state school fund as of 2007. As I mentioned, it's just a two-year provision, basically. The next substantive section is Section 9, and that's really the last significant one in the bill. That makes some adjustments to the local budget law to allow for the school district to actually spend the money, because local budget law normally requires you to provide in your budget as of a certain date, and that also is in July, I believe, how you're going to spend the money. There is a supplemental procedure. This modifies that, again, to take into account that these changes won't be going into effect until 90 days after the end of session. Section 10 of the bill makes it clear that that change as well also applies retroactively to July 1, 2005. And finally, I'd like to highlight Section 12, which is the 91-day effective date, and explain to you why we don't put an emergency clause on this bill. There is a provision in the Constitution that says that any matter regulating taxation or exemption cannot have an emergency clause. Therefore, the earliest it can go into effect is 91 days after the end of session, which is the very later part of October. And that brings up the one other point I want to make. There is a little bit of complexity here. Existing law requires property tax bills to be delivered on October 25th. There's a good chance this bill will not In fact, it's a certainty this bill will not go into effect until after that date. but there is a lot of case law allowing for the retroactive application of tax measures, and that is basically what is going on here.
Thank you. Mr. Warner? That was very helpful, Mr. Johnson. Really helpful.
Madam Chair, I don't have anything to add. Just the revenue impact on the change is for the Portland School District only. It's $15.2 million in 05-06 and $15.8 million in 06-07. These are dollars that would not be counted as local revenue against the formula for a two-year period. So they are increases to the district but have no impact on the other other school districts in the formula.
Thank you. Senator Carter,
thank
welcome.
You. Thank you, Madam Chair and colleagues. I'm just, excuse me, being distracted by Senator Atkinson. Madam Chair and colleagues, I want to tell you the reason we are in the position we are right now. Three things going on that Portland had, Margaret Carter, Senate District 22, North Northeast Portland. First of all of the, we're losing all of our desegregation dollars that usually help in our classrooms. We also are losing, if we were to not pass this bill, our property tax measure piece that would allow us to use this gap bonding. And then Multnomah County passed an income tax, and what we call the ad tax. And we're losing that piece as well. Portland has laid off, Madam Chair and colleagues, 350 teachers, teacher aides, and support staff for the classroom. We are in a position where we would have no other choice for the coming year to lay off equally as many people. We're losing a critical mass of staff people in our district, and we have a new superintendent who's making hard decisions and who is doing a good job of trying to get this district turned around. And I think right now to not give her the tools that she needs to get this job done would not look well for us as a state. Plus, what is happening, we were held so long in abeyance while everybody get caught up. Portland is in a position, in a losing position in this state at this particular point. So the reason I have brought this measure before you is to give us the opportunity to have these dollars, these $31 million, until we can get to the 07 general election to go to the people. And so that's why I'm asking you to support us in this stopgap measure to be able to keep things going for our kids in the Portland School District. And that's why I'm asking you to support us in this effort today.
Thank you. Senator Carter, this proposal would not impact negatively or positively any other school district. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you. Other questions for Senator Carter or the certified smart people that are here? Senator Atkinson.
Thank you very much. Senator Carter.
Yes, sir.
Does the House Republican leadership know about this bill?
They do indeed.
Are they supportive?
I'm sorry, sir?
Are they supportive of this bill?
To my knowledge, they are. They're very supportive of the concept, that's right. And if you will recall, colleagues, this part of the bill was in the speaker's bill at first, and so this was extrapolated out of that, and she would have had support for that as well. So this measure before you right now is nothing new, sir.
Thank you. Madam, a couple more?
Sir,
isn't this the portion that made the speaker's bill have a little bit of heartburn in the House of Representatives?
Needless to say, it did. And but we are working on those persons who had a little heartburn on the other side, and we've gotten some support from them on this issue.
If this bill were to pass, how long would it last?
For 2 years only.
For 2 years.
That's right. And so we can go to the people in November 07.
Who's going to go to the people in 2000?
The school district.
Any further questions, Senator Ferrioli?
I'm sure they have a sense of, not necessarily deja vu, but there's a strong sense here of an issue that resonates because I understand what it feels like for communities to lose their base and to lose their employment and to have shrinking educational opportunities and losing teachers and losing critical mass. That's a thing that we've lived with a lot in the rural communities. I understand the desire to find a safe harbor. Such a safe harbor was offered to the school children in rural Oregon in Public Law 106-393, which appropriated dollars to communities that had lost their timber base. That law was authorized 5.5, I believe, or 6 years ago. It lasts another two. It'll be up for reauthorization in 07. The sense that I'm having of irony here is that those dollars are put into the school funding formula, notwithstanding the plea that rural communities made to have those dollars protected from that distribution formula in the same way that you're asking these dollars to be protected from that distribution formula. And this legislature and its predecessors in three sessions have chosen to turn a deaf ear on those communities and to take those dollars and put them into the school fund for distribution statewide. The amount is about $33 million, as I recall. So I see a sense of irony here that what we're being asked to do is to protect the city of Portland and the Portland Public Schools from the distribution of the dollars that you've raised. And when we asked for protection from the distribution of those dollars that were appropriated by Congress, the answer was not just no, it was hell no.
But, Senator Farioli, some of your colleagues sitting at this dais worked very hard to make that happen.
Yes, ma'am.
I happen to be one of them, and I do believe Senator Carter
very
was
much
another one of them.
All you do is say for kids to Margaret Carter. And you know what, Senator? My rural record probably is better than many rural legislators.
Madam Chair and Senator Carter, my comments are not an indictment against any particular member.
Okay.
Please understand I was referring to the actions of the whole legislature.
Okay.
I'm hoping that perhaps this is an opportunity to revisit that issue.
Okay. Senator, for me, you have support. Because until we can straighten out this issue that we call education in this state, we're going to have to do some things that probably people don't really like. But until this state can realize it has a statewide school board is another thing. That, and we really take seriously what we need to do, we're not going to change a lot of the things that are going on. So, hold the body politic responsible, and that means all the rest of us, even though we support it, we are responsible in that particular kind of way.
Madam Chair, I bring the issue up because there seems to me to be, as I said, it seems ironic. I put my statement on the record. I will salute both of my colleagues, Senator Carter and the Chair, for their efforts to try to address the inequities of the issue of Public Law 106-393. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
You know, I vehemently disagree with Senator Farioli. There are several fundamental differences. One of them is this is a mechanism to allow communities that decide to raise money locally to keep it in their community, and it's their choice to do that. And obviously, if they didn't have that incentive, they probably wouldn't do it. They would never raise the money that was going to be shipped off to Salem. In the case of the federal money, that's not coming locally. It's coming from the federal government, and there's a tremendous inequity in terms of which communities get it. As Senator Farioli knows, John Day gets plunked with $1 million right on its head, and communities 30 or 40 miles down the road that are just as broke get almost nothing. And you look at the runs on where that federal money goes, and there's nothing fair about it. It's not just about helping. Even within rural Oregon, there are all kinds of inequities. Talk about inequities. Right now, $300 or $400 million, I think it's a biennium, flows out of the Portland metro area to support schools in other parts of the state. I'm fine with that. That's what the equalization formula is all about. The Portland area is doing its share and then some to help take care of schools in rural Oregon. I think that's entirely appropriate, but I don't think that has anything to do with because we're seeking this opportunity, therefore federal money ought to be flowing directly to some rural communities.
Thank you. Any questions of the panel? Right. Thank you very much. We really appreciate you joining us. Senator Carter, thanks for bringing this matter before us. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2070? Close the public hearing. Open a work session on House Bill 2122B. This bill is going to be referred to the Senate Ways and Means Committee, Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Wow, I'm glad to hear that.
The joint.
Well, how about if we do the motion like this? The chair will move the House Bill 2122 to the Senate Budget Committee, or in the alternative, if the Senate Budget Committee no longer exists, to the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Madam Chair.
With a due pass recommendation.
I have an alternative proposal that gives you the same options. If you move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation, the president can always make a subsequent referral to the Budget Committee.
Whichever one is operating at the time. Huh?
Okay. All right. Let's move the bill to the Senate floor. It needs some fixing up. We know that. House Bill 2122, I'll withdraw my motion. Senator Farrelly makes a motion to move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Why don't you call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Farrelly?
Aye.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. See what happens. We're still working on House Bill 2327 amendment, but anticipate that will come back tomorrow. Any further business to come before the committee?
Madam Chair, just a comment in response to Senator Ringo's comments earlier. I do respect his views. We differ. We have for a couple of years. I think he represents a perspective that many support. I'm just... appreciate the fact that we have differences and we can talk about those in this forum.
I'm so happy we can talk about them. All right. Anybody else? Anything else to come before the committee? We're adjourned. We really appreciate you coming back this evening. It's probably going to be this way.